I am Blanca.
And I am Ray.
And this is Woke at Work.
I met Amber when we first started teaching in different schools, but within the same org. And we were both teachers, reading teachers, different grades. I didn't connect until many years later when we both became principals. And both were like the first female principals, was it? We were both first female principals in the network. Mm-hmm. And then we were both women of color and we were both like, what the hell are we doing? And then from there, I think it was just like one of those kind of moments where you look at each other, you're like, we ain't got to say much, but wow, this is hard. And then from there, I ended up building a stronger bond where we found out we were both pregnant with our first kids 2 weeks apart. And it was like, guess what? I'm pregnant. Me too, you know, kind of thing. And then it kept going to like, hey, we're sitting at home from maternity leave. Like, we got this email saying, hey, do you guys want to do a doctorate program? We're both sitting there sleep deprived, like pumping and like breastfeeding and texting each other. We're like, let's do it. And so we pursued a doctorate program together and then decided to have a second kid in the process and just have become amazing friends, sisters, and just talk a lot about not just our experiences as people in the world, but as women of color in educational spaces and workspaces, women of color moms, and just different walks of life. So I'm excited to have Amber actually tell her story. I just told about how we met, but there's way more to her than that. Dr. Amber Field.
Oh, wow.
Blanca. Introduce yourself to the listeners.
Thank you, Dr. Ruiz Williams. That was so sweet and thorough. I don't even know my life. This is sound really cheesy. I'm like, I don't know my life before I met you, Blanca. When was it? What happened?
I'll tell you. You shared it with me, but no.
That's true. But I love thinking about my journey and my trajectory into being an educator. And we'll talk a little bit more about the way that I, you know, decided I had made this big change and stepped down from being an educator. But here I am, and I'm still here today. 20 years ago, I love that I get to say 20 years ago, I became a teacher, third grade teacher in Harlem. And I now live two blocks away from my first school where I taught.
Wow.
I always love the way things come back full circle, PS 153. I stayed there for a couple of years, headed over to one of our country's largest our country and our city's largest charter management organizations, and shot up the ranks from teacher, grade level chair, assistant principal, principal, org-wide leader, org-wide senior leader. And then, you know, decided one day that there was still more for me out there and I felt like I hit a ceiling there. And so I went after the big job, and got one, I'd like to think, of course, and headed over and became a graduate level professor and a national director of a training program. And realized that I had done all that and in the meantime earned a doctorate, and realized that I was not where I was supposed to be. I'm a pretty faithful person. I am very faithful. Faith is a foundation. If I were to think about my identity markers, being a woman of faith, being a Christian is the first thing I always say. And I felt called that my life as a K-12 educator and a teacher of teachers had come to an end. And so that I feel, and then I fought it for a long time, said, no, I can't leave this job. Like, I got a mortgage. I have two kids. I have plans. There's a way that I want to live my life, that leaving this job without knowing where I'm going to next, that doesn't make sense to me. And it certainly didn't make sense to my husband, who was like, that's not how he thinks either. He was like, how are you going to leave your job and not have another one laid out? But being faithful and just looking at the numbers, gave myself a window. I gave myself 4 months to resign from my job and just figure out what the world, what God, what the universe had for me, had in store for me.
I love that.
That was August. Yeah.
I love that. I love that story. You know, I feel like this is a theme that comes up in our conversations so often on this podcast is women of color just really owning their lives and making decisions that benefit them, you know, on purpose, even when it's difficult. Can you talk some about your well, I want to hear about your transition from this big name job into doing something different. But first, can you talk about some of your experiences in that big name job? You know, I think we often set our sights on like, I'm going to do that one day. Like you described like being a teacher and then a grade level chair and then, you know, kind of climbing. And then what was when you got this big name job in this big position, this high level executive, was it what you expected it to be?
That is such a great question. So I, you know, I came to this place where I was like, I know I've hit my ceiling in the role that I was in. And I was like, now I'm supposed to be in charge. I'm supposed to be in charge of a big team. I'm supposed to make big decisions. I'm supposed to make more money. And so I was able to, you know, had been in the network for 13 years and able to find that exact position. And so when I got there, it was really hard. It was not, never felt like I fit in, right? There was something about it that always felt off, that I see people, like I'm a friendly person. I create relationships pretty quickly. But there was just something about the work that I really struggled with. I was in charge of the partnership between the graduate school where I was working and a large alternative teaching pathway organization. And I'm in charge of the training for hundreds of teachers in New York City. Mm. And working with this with the other team, I struggled with strategy and really seeing the big picture of everything we needed to see. And I couldn't, and at the same time, the work that I was called to do may have been an important part of the organization I worked for, but wasn't a priority. Mm. So when I came onto the team, my manager, the woman who was managing me, or my direct manager, was not there. She was on maternity leave. And so I had an interim manager who, you know, was just, because everybody needs a manager. And I didn't know how the team functioned. I'm the kind of person that says, well, okay, some work needs to get done. I'm going to go ahead and do it without realizing or knowing the culture of the organization where it was a team effort, right? Mm. And then everybody played a role in executing these large projects. And I don't necessarily feel like anybody told me that either.
Right.
So, right.
That's the thing about culture. It always exists within, you know, spaces and organizations, but it often goes unspoken. And if you are new to that organization, if you are not a part of, even to bring race into it, if you are not a part, if it's a white dominant organization and they have cultural norms and expectations and ways of being, and then we as women of color come in with our cultural background, and even though we've been socialized into white dominant culture, because you can't be a person of color in this country and not be socialized into, you know, white dominant cultural expectations, but it doesn't mean that they're always certainly not explicitly stated. And so just like what you're saying, like about not feeling like you fit in, not feeling like certain things were explained to you, like you were taking on the mantle of doing these things, and probably, I'm assuming, maybe you've gotten the, you know, the accusation of not being a team player or something. You're like, oh, well, I didn't know that was the expectation, you know, in the first place. How did you, when you were
before we do that, because it just makes me think of like, when I feel like when, because I do a lot of stuff on like culture and like how it's a lot of unseen things, but also like what's the scheme, what's the like prior knowledge or the previous stuff that we bring into these spaces, right? And so I know that as I've coached so many women of color, right? But as a woman of color, I don't want to rely on you for fear of you not feeling like I am competent, right? Like I don't, so it's like, it's not even that I don't know how to communicate. There's not even those pieces. But I wonder too, when women of color or like, you know, folks of color, like what does it mean to enter a workspace that is white dominant and feel like I don't want to ask for help or even ask my team to do things or tell my team to do things for fear of it being like not being seen as I don't want to be seen as incompetent, right? Mm-hmm. And so yeah. I end up carrying the weight. Mm-hmm. I end up trying to figure it out. Don't worry, y'all. I got this. Right? Yes. Like I'm gonna figure this out, right? And so I don't know. It's just like I know you were gonna ask something, Ray, but I was like, it just makes me think of, hold on. Like Amber and I joked about this. Olivia Pope. I figure this out, right? I'm walking with my badass outfit and I'm gonna figure this out, right?
Yeah. Like what does she say? She says, I'll handle it. That is always her line. I'll handle it. And so what you both are bringing up is very much so my expectation. I know this about myself. I have anxiety around asking questions because, and for wherever that comes from, way down deep in the seed of my existence and my subconscious, that for me, questions reflect incompetence. They reflect things that I should already know the answer to. And then when I take a step back and look at it, I'm like, I just joined an organization. How in the world would I know the answers to all of these questions? And I also see there's such a difference in the way people experience new positions and when things are off, right? Mm-hmm. So, because what does it mean for me to ask questions like, well, who's in charge of this? How has this been done before? Why are we doing it like this? Why can't we do it this other way?
Did you ask those questions or is that in retrospect you feeling like those are questions that you should have asked? Because I feel like I've often experienced, like as a woman of color, I am always battling my own mind in terms of like, okay, I don't want to come off as too challenging, you know? And so if I do start to ask those probing kinds of questions of, well, why are we doing it this way? Or have we considered it that way? And what about this? Then I'm afraid I'm going to come off as overly aggressive, you know?
Of course. Well, yeah. And I did not ask those questions. I felt like I needed to, you know, take what I understood about the expectations and work with that. And then I didn't want to be too, I didn't want to ask too many questions or rock the boat too much. Right. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I was in my household, my mother's message, who I love dearly. She's one of my best friends. She raised me to quote unquote, keep the peace. Mm-hmm. And that is how I function. And then something that's like always in my head though, I pay attention to over these past few years as I've grown, is the way that people, who gets to ask questions. And who gets to come to the table and say, wait a minute, like something's not right.
Right.
And I have had conversations with people who push back, rightfully so, when they don't understand something. And I'm like, oh, look at the way that they have come to the table right now and advocated and said, this doesn't make any sense, right? Because if you look back at it, and this is certainly not in any way to blame, but to say, okay, you have a brand new large budget project we're kicking off, very important partnership with a brand new team member that has no boss. Like who is responsible for thinking that through?
That's the impact. So like, you know, when that's the impact, like oftentimes I always say to people, like people looking for like the magic, like where's white supremacy, right? No longer is it about these cloaks and all these other things, but this is the impact of supremacy culture, right? And I think it's also like an impact of male dominance, right? To be a woman and to like figure out what the space is, to be a woman and be a person of color, then to figure out these spaces. And then to have to think, how am I showing up? How is that going to be perceived? I'm exhausted by the time the damn question comes out. Like I've thought about all of these things before I even had to ask the question, right? And so it just makes me think about, like, you know, as you share in that, Amber, that, you know, you've already had all of these pre-thoughts before you even show up, if you want to just ask a question. It's not even like being conflict driven or being the dissident. I just need clarity, but that my clarity may be misinterpreted as Ray said, as I'm not culture aligned. I'm not a fit. Mm-hmm. I'm not all these other things. It just is like, I just think about the weight that is put on. And so then, so you know what? I'm not going to ask any questions. You know what I am going to do? I'm going to handle it. I'm going to figure it out. Right. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, I mean, I know Amber and I have talked about this, like on our virtual version of Therapy Couch, like for years, right? It's just like, well, what does that even mean? And so I always say this to listeners out there who are white and are in organizations and like have folks that they're working with, right? Seeing how people show up and work, while it's not all aligned, everything is not different, there are multiple layers that we are bringing in terms of our identities. And that's a function of white privilege, is that you don't get to think about all of that. You don't have to think about all of that, right? Yeah. But that we have already come in the door, not only thinking about it, but have experienced it, right?
Mm-hmm. So Amber, when did you know that you needed to do something different? It sounds like you were mostly, like, I guess, unsupported and not really set up for success in terms of being new, your direct manager being out, not really being onboarded to the culture. That is the benefit of mentorship and sponsorship, in especially for people of color in white dominant organizations. You have someone that understands, you know, your lens and where you're coming from and how you operate, and can help onboard you, you know, to this other environment and their set of expectations. And so it sounds like you didn't have that, but decided to make the best of it, you know, anyway, to charge forward, to handle it, like Olivia Pope said. But when did you realize that you no longer wanted to fight that fight? Starting a podcast has taught me so much. I feel like I'm always learning about new concepts and professions, especially from our guests.
I know, right? And at the same time, I feel like I've always got so much more to learn.
That's why Blinkist, which has quickly become one of our favorite ad sponsors, has been such a huge help to us both. Blinkist takes the need-to-know information for thousands of nonfiction books and condenses them down into 15-minute clips that you can read or listen to.
Blinkist has a book on just about every topic you can think of. I use Blinkist to sort through my options and choose the book I want to read next.
They're also great for interview preparation with our guests. If I need to know more about the field of work one of our guests is in, Blinkist has clips from books that can teach me all I need.
Right now, for a limited time, Blinkist has a special offer just for our audience. Go to Blinkist.com/woke, W-O-C, and try it for free for 7 days and save 25% off your new subscription.
That's Blinkist, spelled B-L-I-N-K-I-S-T, Blinkist.com/W-O-C to start your free 7-day trial. And you'll also save 25% off, but only when you sign up at Blinkist.com/W-O-C. But when did you realize that you no longer wanted to fight that fight?
Oh, through all the tears. let me see. 2016. Oh, it was.
I'm laughing because I think I know the moment. But
please tell me what was it. But like, I mean, this was a very layered decision.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. And that happened over time, because I went into year two ready to go at it again. Mm-hmm. Because I was like, okay, year one was a struggle. And I was still in the, I have to make all the changes, that the things that didn't work out were a reflection of my faults. And so I'm going to make all of these changes. And it actually was in two things happened. One, in my end of year review, sitting with who I consider to be a great advocate for me, my manager who eventually did come back. When we were reviewing, you know, my performance, and I was reflecting on, I think it was about, I didn't, you know, like speaking up or advocating, right? It was that moment. And then she was like, you know, in my previous job, I had a similar challenge, and it was because I didn't want to do the job. And she's like, and I said, oh my God, I don't want to do this work. She's like, great, don't do it. And in that moment, I stepped down from the role. It was that quote. It was that easy, or her support in that role to say it's okay. And it wasn't. I didn't experience it in the you are incapable and I'm firing you. It was this is not right. The right fit for you. Mm-hmm. And I respect you enough to and I want you here. And let's find the right fit for you.
Yeah.
So that happened first, and then the second thing that happened was I was having. This is where my spirituality comes in. I know God was banging, like hitting me over the head with, it is time for you to change. This is not the walk that I have planned for you. Mm. And that was in the fall. That was the fall of 2017 where I know he was saying, you have to leave. You have to leave. You have to step down. And I was scared. And then I was making all these shifts and changes to make it all work.
Yeah.
And then in the spring of 2018, you know that time at work where everybody announces promotions and mm-hmm. when they're leaving mm-hmm. and changes? Before that meeting, I decided, I was like, okay, I'm going to make this work. And I sat in that meeting and fought to hold all the tears back because I heard everybody saying they were leaving, they were promoted, they were moving on. And I was like, I couldn't do it. I couldn't take it any longer. And I was like, I have to go. I have to leave. And I held my tears in that meeting and like left the room and broke all the way down. And I came home that night and I told my husband, I have to go.
Yeah.
And that was at that moment that I had to make a strong decision that this was not it. And it was time for me to leave.
I identify with that. Because that sounds almost exactly like how I left my previous job. It was just like a series of like me trying to come to grips with the fact that, you know, one, I felt very much unsupported in that role, but two, really having the realization that I didn't want that role. And I don't know why mm-hmm. that was so hard for me to admit. I don't know if it was just like, I didn't want to, it felt like failure. It's like, there is nothing I can't do if I put my mind to it. You know, I can mm-hmm. make it work. I can fix the thing. I can be great. You know, all of this, it's all fixable. And then finally realizing like, you know what? It just isn't. And it was like a series of things. It's like, oh, okay, I'm gonna go to part-time. Okay, I'm going to go to less than part-time, like trying to ease my way, inch my yes. way out of it. And then finally being like, my therapist was just like, what are you doing? Like, what are you doing? Like, you don't want to do this. And I don't know why it was so hard to just let it go. But I so identify with you, like sitting there in that moment, all full of emotion and just mm-hmm. being like, you know what? Okay.
I do wonder how much of this also has to do, sorry, but I do wonder how much of this also has to do with like representation. If not me, then who? Mm, right? Like yes. I'm here for all the people who are saying because of me, I can, right? Like, and so particularly, I mean, I think in both of, you know, in all of our spaces, we have all worked in education in a different capacity. And so yes, education has been around forever, but the amount of people that seem to move up to these like senior level positions within education starts to dwindle as, you know, as women of color, like the numbers just dwindle. And so it's like, well, wait, I'm helping to charter a path, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Oftentimes mm-hmm. like the first of people, right? Like if we had to really think about like, well, wait, has anybody else held this role? Am I the person who held this role first? And it's just mm-hmm. like, well, you know, so it's not, I always feel like I'm not leaving even when I left like my principal role, my first thing was not about why I left it for me and my own personal reasons, but like the impact it would have on all the other people who saw this as some form of like, you know, like I was carrying a whole lot. And so I just wonder like how much of that too was in there. But like, I know that for you. I will tell you. Yeah.
When I decided to step down and we made the decision, I was on the leadership team. Like I was on the senior leadership team at all the head, you know, exec level meetings. And that was not from everybody, but that was the thing that other people of color came up to me and said. Like I specifically remember one conversation that said, I'm just so disappointed that you're no longer at the table.
Yeah, that's such a burden to carry.
And the weight had come off my shoulders. I was like, yeah, I'm not gonna hold that for you. But I recognize the way that people saw me and the importance of my role in the organization, and it was important that I was able to be at the table, you know. But we had to make decisions, right?
So tell us what that opened up the door for, like what happens? Because I feel like this is like a good story. And like, okay, so then we got through all of that. And now,
where are you? Yes.
Or what happened after that?
Okay. What happened after that?
I feel like I should be having a drink right now. Girl, tell me what happened next. Tell me.
Front row seat.
What she said.
Yeah. So after trying to, like you said, Ray, go back, I was like, okay, can we do 80%? Okay. Can we do 50%? I was trying to work all that out. Right. Cause at the end of the day, 50% is more than no job at all. Right. So I was like still trying to hold on to my salary. But I, in August of 2018, I fully 100% resigned, and people asked, what are you going to do? And I said, I have no idea. I said, it will come to me. And he will show me what it is that he wants me to do, speaking of God. And from August through December, I had lots of coffee with friends. I did a lot of volunteering, a lot of running. I run and just figuring out like what else the world had to offer. And one of the things that I love that I came to was that I learned that it was okay to live life on God's terms. Because I live life on, I think as a society, for myself, I had goals around living life on like society's terms and expectations of what success looked like and what it looks like to climb the ladder and how I should raise my kids. And I finally let go and realized, you know, God actually has a greater plan, a better plan than mine or anybody else's. And if I could let go and go along with what he's telling me to do, I bet it's going to be better than anything I could have ever dreamed of. And it has been. I ended up coming across, starting in January, I started looking again for another position. After I learned a couple of things. One, I learned that I've always known that I had I'm obsessed with reading social justice nonfiction. And I had this question like, how do we fix racism? And what that boiled down, right? What can I do, Jesus? What can I do to end racism? What it boiled down to me was helping people to see each other and to see the humanity in every single person. And so I realized I have a heart for people experiencing homelessness. I started an organization called Ready to Give, which does two things. One, it helps people, regular people who are, helps people know what to do and what to say when they're asked for money on New York City subways and New York City streets. We're approached. We don't know. We get really awkward and we ignore people, but there is something that you can actually do within reason that's helpful. And so I help people understand that. And that is about like giving tangible resources, but it's also about widening your circle of compassion. And so my answer to the question of can racism be fixed? There's a lot in there, but Amber field's answer is that we can start with seeing the humanity of each other.
That's so great.
And so that, yeah. And so I started that organization. We host dinners to train people on how to do that work. I started teaching in my church, and I feel called to ministry and preaching. And so I started doing that. And then I started working for an organization focused on Black women's health and wellness. I'm the director of training there, and it is a 100% Black female organization. And going back to living on God's terms, I would have never come up to that in my own way.
Yeah.
Like that came to me.
Mm-hmm. No, I was going to say, what was the transition like? I mean, that's like a full on 360. You just went from like, I guess it's not 360, but you just shifted completely from what you had been doing for like
15 totally
years.
Yeah.
Yeah. So like, what was that like? And what was it like to even go to a Black female like wellness, or like, this is not about other people. It is about centering you and your wellness before others. And then mm-hmm. as a path for others. So like, what was that like?
Oh, first of all, it was a blessing. Because I think we all know, I firmly believe that we all know when things are off and when things are just not right. And I think I held on to this life a decade, 15 years longer than I probably should have, to be perfectly honest with you, right? So I felt secure in knowing that there is life outside of this life that I created, right? Or that I thought I needed to live. And so what was it like? It was a small organization, just with like around 15, 16 women. And the first thing I noticed about it is the focus on living the mission that they've designed for the women that we serve, that we live it as a team, in that our self-care, the way that we care for each other, the relationships we have with each other, the way that we think about the work, is the bottom line is on the person. And I think, and obviously, of course, like numbers are important. We set goals and we work hard to reach them. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, we don't do that in a way that ignores the people, like ignores the fact that we are saying that Black women are dying disproportionately from many illnesses and from stress.
Yeah.
So we're going to need to be an organization that does not add to, that is the part, is part of the solution and does not add to the problem.
That really makes me think when Blanca talks a lot about white supremacist cultural values, and you said, you know, we center people, and, you know, I know one aspect of white supremacist culture is this, you know, fascination with numbers and measurement and, you know, things having to be quantifiable in order to be valuable. And it sounds like what you have going on at the organization you work now is, it, like you said, it's not that you all don't set goals and that you don't have measures, but it's not the primary way that you interact with each other and interact with your work. And I think that's super important. It's just a completely different worldview, you know, to center people versus centering, numerical progress and achievement.
Yeah, I think that's right.
I'm just lost, by the way, because I'm like, it's so, that experience for you was like completely movement of a cult. Like it is a complete culture shift. Like it is a, and you and I have talked about this, which is like crazy, but just like to dream outside of what has been a norm for us and to not only be part of the organization, but also to have that as a place of healing is like crazy. It's just, and it shouldn't be crazy. That's the crazy part of it. It's like, it shouldn't be crazy, right? Like, but anyway, I just, I'm saying this also from a place of like utter friendship and knowing how extremely happy I was to know that Amber had found something that had been such a match and a calling, and like almost to the point where it's just like, I don't even know what I don't know, but I'm here and I'm supposed to be here. And so, yeah. So
what I love about your journey is just that, you know, obviously you didn't know the end from the beginning. And so you weren't like at your first, you know, organization being like, okay, I'm going to do this because I see down the line that I'm going to found a nonprofit. I'm going to be more involved in my church. I'm going to find this fabulous job. Like, you didn't know that, right? But I think that your story is a testament to what happens when you own the truth of where you are, the truth of how you're feeling, the truth of whether or not this is actually working for you, and stepping out, whether for you it's stepping out on faith or whatever someone's, you know, belief tradition is, just stepping out of knowing that this isn't working for me. I don't know what's next, but I know this isn't it. And believing that there's something better, you know, something different on the other side of it. And I love that. I feel like as Black women, we don't often have the space to make those kinds of decisions, or sometimes we don't feel like we do. And I love that you owned that moment and have been so open to what's next. So awesome.
The last thing I'll say about it is in speaking of the white supremacist culture is, and now I was raised in a way that said, I have heard the quote in my home when I was raised, just do what white people do. Right? So that design, that framework designed where we lived, the schools we went to, what was and was not acceptable in terms of our career choices. I have grown to understand, and I think that this, you know, speaks to my journey, that it's hard. It kills us when we try to get what was never designed for us.
Oh my gosh, that's so deep. Mm-hmm.
And when we fight so hard, and we know that the bar keeps moving, right? Like, no matter how much we do, we're going to change. The rules are always going to change. And I decided that I don't want to hurt myself, hurt my family. I have two daughters. I don't want to hurt my children in an attempt to prioritize something that was not designed for them. And I believe that we can make different choices and still have outcomes that are in our best interest.
Oh my gosh. Yay. I know. I love that. Quarantine has been such a crazy experience with so many ups and downs. I'm really trying to adopt a growth mindset and take advantage of this time to work on some personal goals.
Same here. And that's why our ad sponsor today is so great. Skillshare is an online learning community with thousands of inspiring classes for creative and curious people.
With so much to explore, real projects to create, and the support of fellow creatives, Skillshare empowers you to accomplish real growth while offering a wide range of classes to fit your schedule.
Girl, I just took a class by Nikki Henderson called Project Management in Real Life. And Lord knows I needed it because these days are all running together. She had a lesson on how to make a schedule, and you can actually stick to that, was so helpful. So I will definitely be using those tips as I move forward through this quarantine.
Explore your creativity and get 2 free months of premium membership at Skillshare.com/WOKE. That's 2 whole months of unlimited access to thousands of classes for free.
Get started and join today by heading to Skillshare.com/WOKE, WOKE. That's 2 free months of unlimited access to thousands of classes at Skillshare.com/WOKE.
We've come to the part in our podcast where we invite our guests to share a wow story. This is like a woke at work story. I cannot believe this just happened. I can't believe this person just said that to me. And so, Amber, do you have a wow story?
I do. So I remember a time when I was helping some teammates across schools navigate a disagreement or some discontentedness around one of our teammates was chosen to do some curriculum work and another one was not. One of the two women, one woman was a woman of color, the other woman was is a white woman. And I had to sit with, or I decided to sit with the white woman to have a conversation about, you know, what she, just to clear the air about what was going on. The decision, by the way, wasn't mine in terms of whose work was chosen. It was chosen by an outside company. And but we all had to work very closely together to design curriculum and you know, for the kids. So I, when I sat down with her, you know, she was just livid. You know, I can't believe that. Why would they, you know, why would they choose her work over mine? I feel like, you know, she, a lot of her work was inspired by my work. And she says, I mean, maybe if they were just looking for a person of color because they needed some diversity.
Oh my gosh. So she played the race card.
She, yes, yes. And,
wow. So?
And in that moment, we can get into my fight or flight or freeze response. I am a woman who keeps the peace. And so I responded very tactfully.
Yeah.
About just, you know, this is, you know, the decision was based on the quality of work and that's the decision that they went with.
Oh my God. Wow. Ew. Yeah. That is definitely, yeah. That's definitely a wow.
It's like you didn't, she didn't see you. Like she didn't look at you and like think any of this either. Like,
there was another person in the room. There was three of us in the room. It was like a conversation between two people. And that's exactly what she said. And I always think about that moment because, this is an organization that serves Black and Brown people, right? Our job is to level the playing field and to provide opportunity. And so there's always an assumption, you know, that organizations like these are ahead of the game. And in a lot of cases, that's not the case. Yeah. It's not true.
Yeah. And that if you're coming to these kind of organizations to do this work, then that you are coming with like a set of beliefs and things that align with, just the purpose of the organization and understanding the nature and the history of discrimination and everything. And so when you have a conversation like that and you talk to somebody and you're like, oh my gosh, you're playing the reverse racism, reverse discrimination argument. You realize, oh, there's some learning that needs to take place before we just entrust anybody really into these spaces with our Black and Brown children.
Absolutely.
Yes, the post-Obama racism, or the Edward Bonilla Silva wrote a book called Racism Without Racism. And it's a whole thing about like, listen, we had this old school way of what racism looks like. And then it's like, then there's this, right? And this is like those microaggressions, right? Those moments where people say stuff and it's just like, well, I didn't, that's not what I meant, right? And it's,
Right.
Her work, the whole conversation. Right, exactly. Right. And then what is it intent when you have to have a conversation about what your intent was? And they're like, I didn't intend, or I didn't
mean intent versus
to
impact.
Say it that way. Thank you. Your intent versus impact. I know you know that. Yeah. And then there wasn't even any realization. Right. And the thing is so interesting, right, is that these things are said without under the cloud of discrimination and racism and oppression, right? That does not even realize what you're saying would be taken in that way. Is where the challenge is.
Well, listen, sis, you're better than me because I have been in those moments and not reacted as peacefully as you have. And then had people act like I'm the crazy person for calling out, you know, the very problematic thing that you just said. So, listen.
Well, you know, this actually makes me think of our Dear Woke at Work portion where we ask listeners to send us questions. And so So we can keep this conversation going, but I do want to like bring in this person's question. They didn't want to give a name, but shout out to you for sending us the question. and those of you who are listening can continue to send us more questions. This person writes, first of all, I'm really excited about this new podcast. Shout out to the new podcast. Thanks for doing this, North Star. Shout out to North Star. I'd love to hear you two discuss microaggressions in the work, or you all to discuss microaggressions in the workplace. And while completing your doctoral degree, I definitely experienced this during my PhD program, and I really struggled with responding appropriately. So my question is, in what ways have you experienced microaggressions as a woman of color? And what's the best way to respond when, capital letters, not if, it happens?
So, yeah, that's the perfect question.
I think we started it because that was a straight up microaggression.
Right. And both of you have so much experience in academia as earning your PhDs. And I'm wondering, like, Blanca, we've had this conversation. We've all had this conversation, like doctor versus not going by your doctor and when that's important and how microaggressions play into that. So I'm curious to know what you two would say to her.
Go ahead, Amber, because I could talk about this in the next episode. No.
Well, I appreciate the way the question is phrased, you know, when it happens, not if it happens, because it will and it does regularly. I would, you know, what this question reminds me of when I was still a graduate level professor and my students would, you know, it's always a question about like how, there was an overall question in our graduate school about how to be how we wanted our students to call us. And in my particular campus, it was inconsistent. If you wanted to go by your first name, you could. If you wanted to go by Professor Smith, you could do that too. And I felt a great deal of necessity around calling myself Dr. Field. Mm-hmm. Now, anybody can call me Amber. And honestly, like in email communications, I texted with my students. There was a piece of me that was like, I really just want to go by Amber. Oh. But I also felt the need to make a statement to society, to our students who were being trained, like mostly white students being trained to go into Black and brown communities to go by Dr. Field. And I think it's because I wanted to make sure that, you know, that there was a level of respect that was always given. Mm-hmm. And that I worked and then for me in my own work to, you know, my own internal oppression, just thinking about like, I've worked hard for this and I don't need to lessen myself in any way to make other people feel comfortable. Mm-hmm. And so it was important for me to go by Dr. Field in those situations. And that was a real challenge because I had students who refused to call me Dr. Field, no matter how many times I referred to myself as Dr. Field or use Dr. Field in a signature, you know, the email that came back was Amber.
Oh, wow. Did you notice the difference? Like, were white students more prone to calling you Amber or? You
absolutely.
Know? Okay.
100%. And even our young, and I would say our younger students, I had a range of ages in my class, and my older white students, they did not have, I'm not making any kind of claim about this. I just am remembering, you know, that there was a specific, my younger white students just refused to call me Dr. Field.
This could have been your other wow story, but tell everybody else about that time.
Oh, in the classroom. Yes. Yeah. So before class, one day before class started, I was chatting with my student, and one of my white male students was, you know, he always called me Mrs. Field. So no matter how many times I said Dr. Field, always called me Mrs. Field. And this particular day, it was the end of the year, and we were, you know, closing out. And I said, and I mentioned, I was like, I'm Dr. Field. And he's like, oh, you're Dr. Field? And then I had other students of color who were in the air, like who were, you know, just in earshot of the conversation. There's three of them. And all three of them said in some way, yes, she's Dr. Field. Mm. And that moment really struck me in terms of not only like the impact that him always calling me Mrs. Field had on me, but the way that my other students experienced the same thing, my other students of color experienced it. And we talk and a lot about moment, how
it sounds
we,
like you decided. Mm-hmm. Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
No, it's okay.
It sounds like, you know, you decided to call that out, you know, like our, it sounds like mm-hmm. our listener's question was like, how do you deal with it when it happens? And I remember being in a workshop that Blanca was leading one time. And I loved an answer that she gave to this because so many young people are just like, I know this is a microaggression. I have the language for it. I see it. I understand it. You know, do I call it out? Is it being obnoxious? And Blanca's answer was like, listen, it's up to you, right? Like you don't, mm-hmm. first of all, you don't owe it to your race to call it out. You know, you don't owe it to anybody. Mm-hmm. Like if you don't feel like dealing with it that day, if you don't feel like doing the emotional labor, you don't feel like putting in that level of work, then, you know, whatever. Like I found her response so freeing. Like, yes, you can call it out. If you want to name it and address it, then say, yeah, like what you did, it's actually Dr. Field, you know, because that's a little bit of mm-hmm. an uncomfortable moment that not everybody is willing to step into. And there are days when we feel like stepping into and there are days when we don't, and that we get to make that decision from moment to moment, you know, issue to issue. I found to be like a really freeing response to how you deal with microaggression. Some days, yeah, I'm gonna call you out because I'm feeling mm-hmm. that, you know, and then other days mm-hmm. I'm just tired and I'm be like, okay, go be ignorant, and, you know?
Like the thing I used to, like, I'll tell people, to answer, there are two questions. One, Ray is like the whole doctor thing. I don't often go by doctor, but everyone else seems upset by the fact that I don't. So then now I'm like, yeah, I'm gonna go by, I'm about to change my Instagram handle to be like doctor somewhere in there.
I am one of those people always telling you, doctor.
And I should, only because the reason why I stuck with it, Amber knows this, like, I think we each collectively, like, I think tried to drop out 20 times. We're like, we can't do this. And I was like, the only thing that kept me going was at the time, it was 2.5% Latinas with doctorate degrees. And that's pretty damn depressing. So that's why I did it. So I guess I should embrace it and hold it. But to answer like the, what do you say or how do you say, let's say you do decide to disrupt, because part of it is, for me is like, I do get to choose if I'm going to put myself in harm. And also understanding that the third time are you doing this, now I'm pissed. So now yeah. I should say something, right? But I do, they're like different frames that I've actually said to people where I'm like, one, you could just name it, right? Like, I don't know if you realize what you said, but this is the impact it had on me, right? Like, so that's that impact intent language. So this is your, while that might not have been your intention, and I don't really know what your intention is, the impact it had on me. And I want you to sit with it, right? Like, cause that's like, that's not my work. Mm. That's not my emotional labor. Mm-hmm. Like, I want mm-hmm. you to sit with it. I want you to think about it. And then if it's someone white, and I want you to have that conversation with other white folks and y'all can process it, but that's the impact it had on me. And I think that's completely mm-hmm. fine, right? And it feels a little uncomfortable and all that stuff. But I think there are other times that you're like, I want you, can you repeat what you said? And I want you to listen to yourself.
mm-hmm.
And I want you to think about, you know, like just for a second, as a person, as a woman of color hearing this, is it like, what do you think I'm processing? Cause I'm like, most of the times we do the lifting, right? Like as people yeah. of color, and that's hella frustrating, right? And so to say mm-hmm. like, I'm going to help you understand versus nah, this is your consciousness, right? Your level of consciousness that you need right. to do. And I don't know what it was you said, Amber, but like, it made me think something you said about earlier. I just pulled up the Ta-Nehisi Coates that I use often where he's talking about, you know, like if he's writing to his son, you are growing into consciousness, and my wish for you is that you feel no need to constrict yourself to make other people comfortable, right?
Yeah.
And so, like, whoever this listener is, and there's many of us who this is, like, I shouldn't have to constrict myself to make other people feel comfortable. And yeah, I recognize right. that in some spaces, right, it's a matter of survival. It's a matter of, like, keeping my job. It's a matter of, like, not being labeled. But that the idea that I have to, so choosing to not say something sometimes is a form of me not like trying to, you know, I'm not constricting myself right now. And so I yeah. can walk away mm-hmm. from the conversation.
Yeah.
So
awesome. Yeah. Hope that helps to our listener. It's up to you. If you feel like doing battle, do it. They're calling somebody out, but letting them do the work.
Let them do it.
Yes, let them do it.
I know.
Okay, awesome.
And I would,
go ahead, Amber.
I was just going to say that I think that's important, and this is an important reminder for me, right? That we're going to, whether or not we do the work, and if we choose not to do the work, like we will leave, and we will carry that moment with us.
Yeah, that's
right?
True.
And it'll stick with us, and we're going to carry the load of it regardless.
Yeah, that's
true. And, you know, just to, and I think in some cases that conversation might not even be able to be finished, and you might even be fully present for it if you can't call it out and stop it in the moment and say, this just happened and I need to address this. So I just thought about that while you were talking.
Okay. Awesome.
Oh, wait, can I offer one more nugget? This is it though. Amber knows we used to have this mentor, this woman who was like old school New York district, Department of Ed, you know, like older white woman too. And she used to tell us she had a 24-hour rule. So she's like, listen, if somebody says something or something you mad about, address it. You got 24 hours. So like not everything also needs to be addressed in the moment. So sometimes mm-hmm. I'm so heated when I hear things, I'm like, and it's okay to respond out of anger, but it's also out of my own emotional safety. I'm not actually entertaining this conversation, but I'm gonna let you know about how I feel, just not today. So just I got 24
yeah.
hours.
Yeah.
Just not today.
Yeah.
So that was it, listener. Right. That was okay. it. Sorry.
Love
okay,
that.
Okay, we're done.
Okay. Now let's go. First of all, this is just an aside, but if people knew, like, first of all, we're such baddies. I mean, seriously, here we are holding down kids, trying to keep them at bay. We've been having this conversation, setting up recording remotely, looking at each other, testing mics, you know, kids beating down the doors, trying to get to us, dismissing babysitters. Like, I just want to acknowledge that in the middle of COVID-19, here we are, like, really doing the daggone thing, making it happen. Mm-hmm. So shout out to us, you all.
Yeah, I know. I'm taking shots. It's actually no joke. Ginger shots from Trader Joe's. I was
you
one
said
of the
vinegar?
No, ginger.
Oh, no.
I gotta hold off on the vinegar just in case I need it for cooking in another month or so.
Girl, listen.
No. Yeah.
The way we are rationing right now, I'm just like, do you really need two pieces of bread for that sandwich? Right? Like,
hold it. Hold that bread.
Right?
You're gonna eat crust today.
Oh my gosh, that's where we are.
Rob is like texting me in the background. Can I go to the store?
Go and take your kids with you.
Right? Exactly.
Okay.
Y'all need to go ahead. All right. Yeah.
Okay, you all. So we've come to the part of our show where we want to leave our listeners with an affirmation, just something positive that you want them to, you know, think about and consider as they finish listening to this interview. So, Amber, what is your affirmation?
Affirmation.
My affirmation is there is nothing wrong with you.
Just like that. Awesome. I love it. There is nothing wrong with you. There's nothing wrong with any of us. We are all doing our best. So thank you so much for joining us and like making it happen in the midst of all the madness. Hope our listeners really, you know, just appreciate all that you shared with us today. Okay, so I really loved talking to Amber, Dr. Amber Field. what I'm taking away from this interview, you know, I just keep thinking about the fact that she had this whole life plan, like so many of us women do. You know, she's going to go to this school and get this degree and become a teacher and then a grade level chair and then principal and so forth and so on, and really climb that ladder to reach this position, only to realize that that wasn't what was feeding her soul. Mm-hmm. And I love that she made a different choice and you know, actually didn't even just go from, okay, this position, let me look and see what else is out there, and then right on to the next position and then the next position. Like, she took a minute. She took some time to rest and to wait, yep, and to, you know, let her spirituality guide her, spend some time with God, and, you know, let whatever was going to be next evolve out of that. And I love that she took that time to really care for herself and listen to herself in that way.
Yeah, no, and my takeaway from it too is kind of, it's sort of similar. You know, I think when she ended with her affirmation, right, that there's nothing wrong with us, right? I think, you know, just in our experiences of having been in white dominant organizations or white dominant spaces, we start to question ourselves. We start to doubt mm-hmm. ourselves. We start to, like, mm-hmm. you know, the gut check doesn't necessarily work all the time. Or so we think it doesn't, right? And so, you know ourselves, and we just have to be attuned again with who we are and know that we are enough, right? And that, that despite the messages that we have been sent, we know ourselves enough. And so how do we tap back into that is really just what I've been thinking about, what I keep thinking about, is how do we tap back into listening to our souls and allowing our souls mm-hmm. to be guided, whether it's by a spiritual being, by ourselves, by, you know, things that we've yeah. been grounded in. So lots to learn, to have learned, and like to listen to my sister, Dr. Friend. So I'm glad to have that.
He has the best voice too, right? Like, she has the best voice for interviewing. Like, I've never met her because obviously, like we talked about, we recorded right. this in COVID, but she sounds so at peace and just like one with the world. I'm like, how can I get some of that? That's
yeah, awesome. I mean, I be trying to get some of that, but she's too busy for the little people over here. I'm like, could you please push some stuff off your plate so you could talk to me? She's always running and doing something. But I'm so happy that she made time so she could share her gifts with us all. You know, I keep talking about everybody who we interview, they have gifts to share. And so glad that she was able to share her gifts with you all and with us. So I'm grateful for you, Dr. Amber Fields.
We trying to stay woke at work. We trying to stay woke at work. How about you? You trying to stay woke at work? If you trying to stay woke at work, stay true, stay true. We trying to stay woke at work. We trying to stay woke at work. How about you? You trying to stay woke at work? Woke at work, woke at work. Stay true, stay true.
Shout out to the North Star for making Woke at Work possible. If you are not a member of the North Star, you can head over to thenorthstar.com, create an account, and enjoy some of the paid content in addition to the free content that we offer. Thank you to the thousands of members who currently support this work that make this podcast, other podcasts, and all types of media that we offer, Speaking Truth to Power, possible. So again, that's thenorthstar.com. We really appreciate your support. I also want to thank Lysandra, our podcasting director, Willis, our producer, who is also responsible for this awesome music, as well as Tone and everyone else behind the scenes who make this podcast work.
Now, if you want to support us, please go to your favorite podcasting app and subscribe, and please leave a review. We'd appreciate it so much if you could leave your best review on Apple Podcasts or Stitcher. If any of your other podcasting apps accept reviews, by all means, leave one there too. So remember, whether you're listening on Instagram, the North Star website, or wherever you listen to this, we appreciate you showing us your love by going to a podcasting app, subscribing, and leaving a review. Thanks so much, y'all, for all the love and support. And don't forget to tell a friend. We appreciate you.